Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An hour now exploring the tension, the differences, and the importance of understanding symbolic change versus tangible social action. This is a day certainly to think about the late South African writer Nadine Gordimer, South Africa's first Nobel Prize winner, the first African-American U.S. president, Barack Obama, and the first woman to get a major party nomination for vice president of the United States, Geraldine Ferraro. But first, a word from the convener-in-chief.
We've pulled together private philanthropies and businesses, mayors, state and local leaders, faith leaders, nonprofits, all who are committed to creating more pathways to success.
Faced with an uncooperative Congress, President Obama has turned increasingly to programs like My Brother's Keeper, a program focusing on the problems of young African-American men, to motivate and encourage social change. He has found support, but a few weeks ago, more than 1,000 black women and several hundred black men signed letters to the president asking him to include young women of color in the Brother's Keeper program. What is this debate really about, and is this an appropriate use of the presidency to make real social change? Two voices now. Mary Frances Berry wants women included. She's the former chairwoman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Mary Frances Berry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
And with us is Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's awesome.
So what do you think, both of you, just to start, are the advantages and limitations to these, for lack of a better word, sort of self-esteem building, gender-based, in part symbolic, but in part very, very concrete and tangible programs targeted at African-American men and women?
So the advantages are primarily symbolic. They represent kind of a symbolic outreach to a population, to a specific population that many people acknowledge is suffering. But there are actually a lot more limitations. So with My Brother's Keeper specifically, we have a program that's explicitly articulated as not being a government program, which means that it's very difficult to transition this program into a government program, the type that may actually benefit black men and black people materially. Secondly, is that the way it's articulated is it's articulated in which a significant number amount of the blame is kind of placed on black boys and black men. And that type of thing actually makes it harder for us to deal with the structural issues than if a program like this didn't even exist, I would argue.
Would you say that a program similar for African-American women is unacceptable, needless, superfluous, really important? What would you say about that, Lester?
What I would argue is that if the program is not a big government program, one, is kind of implicitly and explicitly based on the idea that the problems that black girls and women face are their fault, then I would actually say that no, a program like this, what it would look like, to be honest, My Brother's and My Sister's Keeper program would basically be a program that suggests that black boys have to pull their pants up and black girls have to do their best to keep their legs closed.
So, Mary Frances Berry, I suspect you might have something to say there.
Well, I have something to say about the whole thing. Look, the initiative is political. The president is making a political initiative because he hasn't done very much about the issue of black folk since he's been in office. The civil rights issues, they've done a lot of justice, but on the social and economic issues, black unemployment is, as we know, the rate is higher than it was when the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. And all of the black politicians and the caucus and other people have tried to get him to do something, to have some kind of targeted program to deal with it, and he hasn't. And black boys have parents and they need jobs, and he hasn't done a doggone thing, excuse the expression, about that. The other part of it is it buys into and can get bipartisan support because of what Lester says. It blames black boys and black people for whatever's wrong, and then foundations and various players that will come to respond to the president are supposed to buy into it. The reason why it ought to include girls, if it is to go forward, is because if anything results from it, we might as well understand that you cannot solve the problem of black boys without solving the problems of their sisters and of their relatives who are female. The bottom line is it's a political program. If it's to have any benefit at all, then it ought to have benefit for girls and boys. The unfortunate thing about it is that it does buy into the narrative, which was pushed by Republicans mainly, and now Democrats have embraced it, as they have many things that Republicans only used to embrace, that black people are responsible, the community is responsible. It avoids dealing with unemployment, entrepreneurship, all the structural issues that have to deal with black adults. And so Lester's right about that. But I think it's going to go forward because the president has it as an initiative, and it might as well include girls.
All right. I'm sensing a very big headline here. But before I get to that, in terms of agreement from the two of you, could you address, Mary Frances, the idea that this is coded language for keep your pants up and your legs closed, which is what Lester said there at the end of his remarks a moment ago?
I don't think it's coded. The narrative is very clear in what was announced. It seem as if this is a way that we're going to solve this problem. Somebody said, I've forgotten who, that the problem is not the brothers, but the problem is the keepers. I would say the problem is not the girls, but it's the keepers. It's the keepers are the social and economic structure that exists in this society that perpetuates families and problems and the opportunity for this kind of problem to exist in our community.
So maybe the program we need to be talking about here is, my first African-American president's keeper initiative, that basically we've got both of you seeming to suggest that this two terms of the Obama administration has been a complete disaster in terms of how you deal with the issues of African-American economic justice, in that while, Thomas Piketty and Cornel West, and I could throw in Tavis Smiley and half a dozen other economists, Skip Gates, are talking about serious structural problems with American capitalism in the 21st century, and all the president's got is this kind of, penmanship award program here called My Brother's Keeper, and both of you are on the verge of starting to throw some real Molotov cocktails.
I can say that the initiative will go forward. It may do some good. Let's include girls in it, too. But it is not going to address the structural problems. And that's a big word, but it just means, unemployment and all the social and economic deficits that exist in the black community that have been there a long time and will be there after Obama is gone, and which he has done practically nothing, and trickle down didn't work. I mean, all the great things that have been done hasn't worked. If you look at the unemployment numbers alone, you can tell that it's not just something we're making up. And I think that most of us are so happy to have Obama elected president and to get reelected and have a black guy be at this point that it's people are reluctant. That's why they pray for him in churches every Sunday, and why people, want him to do well and not attack him even when they see that there are problems. And that's why they attack people like Tavis and Cornell and others when they do say something about it.
But nobody wants this administration to be cover for inaction for 8 years, right? What's going to push this administration to the kind of historic shifts? And let's give Obama credit for at least, pulling the nation out of the worst recession that he was handed. And, I'll give him the wars even as well.
Yeah.
But still, what's going to push this administration to the point where we are talking about the kind of historic changes that Lyndon Johnson gets credit for all of his problems and all that was handed to him, in 1964?
Not going to happen in this administration. There's not enough time and there's not enough will and in Congress, and there are not going to be enough people in the African-American or progressive community to press on Democrats to get them to address these issues because people are scared of the Republicans with good reason. So therefore, it's going to be the next president, whoever that is, that's going to have to be pressed. And I think people, progressives and African-Americans will press the next president much harder to have something done. We just have to realize that we got Obama and it's wonderful. But there have been so many problems that he has to deal with, and the world is a problem, increasingly, all these issues. And the reluctance to push him, because he is our first African-American president, that these just problems are going to be left unattended.
Lester?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is something that's going to take more than a single or even two presidential terms. What we have to do is, and there are a number of people in local areas here in Baltimore, in Detroit, where I'm from, in St. Louis, that are starting to organize and is starting to kind of recapture this argument for labor, defined broadly. And I think what a number of us are trying to do is connect those struggles together to the point where we can actually start to make substantive change at the local, the state, and the federal level. That's what's going to do it. It's not going to be, I don't think the infrastructure exists. The infrastructure exists to be critical of the president. I think Mary's absolutely right. The next president will probably catch, rightly so, far more flat than this one has. But in order to make the fundamental change, in order to really roll back these inequality rates, both within racial groups and between them, then we're going to have to do a lot more groundwork, a lot more organizing on the ground, a lot more.
Because in order to make social change, we're reminded of that here in the 50th anniversary of the 64 Civil Rights Act and the War on Poverty. You need a movement. And we have not had a movement that would galvanize the public in such a way that these, what we call structural issues, could be addressed. And that hasn't happened. And that isn't the president's fault, but it hasn't happened. So that's where we are.
Mary Frances Berry is the former chairwoman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Lester Spence, professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip Hop and Black Politics. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We should also mention that we reached out to the White House to reflect on this conversation. We've had no response, but we'll keep you posted if they get back to us. Sounds like a little bit of preaching to the choir out there for some of you on this issue.
Ethan Denault, Tampa, Florida. Forget Republican intransigence. Obama has done literally nothing as president to improve the economic status and safety of minorities in this country.
But from Cocoa, Florida, I believe Mr. Obama's role as our first black president is not to be an activist, but to prove by his presence that anything, including the highest office in the land, is within reach. The statement made by just being there is stronger than using that office as a biased bully pulpit.
This is Keith from Augusta, Georgia. No president, no public official, in fact, should do anything for minorities any more than she or he should for the majority. Public offices are public trust and should be executed to serve their ethical purposes, not to serve special interests.
Do you think President Obama has done enough for minority communities? Vote in our poll at thetakeaway.org. You can also call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment on this on facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Remember the old Clinton campaign days?
It's the economy, stupid.
James Carville there. Today, it's the internet, stupid, or at least the internet economy, that will be driving campaign tactics as we head into the fall. Micro-targeted ads, the personalized social media campaigns, and the big data-driven initiatives. It's almost as though the campaigns have taken a few lessons of people-watching from the NSA. Kara Miller is host of Innovation Hub from our partners PRI and WGBH in Boston. She's been following how the campaigns are quickly changing with new technology.
I mean, what we're looking at is 2014 really being a test drive for 2016, which is where the really, really big money and the techies are coming in strong. So one thing we've seen, just a sort of taste of things to come, is you look at a situation like House Majority Leader Eric Cantor getting defeated just a few weeks ago by David Bratt. And one of the things that happened is that David Bratt built a strong community online of Twitter followers, of Facebook followers, and he realized, and the people who ran his campaign was actually run by a 23-year-old, but they realized that getting people to really care about you and then go evangelize on your behalf is crucially important to politics. So here's Jonathan Alter, who has written a lot about Obama's 2012 team and the approach that they took to this social media campaign.
What was so extraordinary about the Obama campaign is they were able to recreate, especially in 2012, where there were great advances over 2008, they were able to recreate this older kind of politics using technology to recreate neighbor-to-neighbor, friend-to-friend politics.
And Alter makes a great point there, but to sort of unify it with the Eric Cantor headline, which was a big shocker, I mean, you know, we're starting to see that this kind of social media technological approach can really be decisive when in a primary for an off-year election, you know, you can do stuff that moves the needle with just 36,000 people. I mean, that was all that was really at stake there in that Virginia district that turned Cantor out of office. So, you know, at the primary level, the numbers here are very, very important.
Exactly. And in a lot of ways, it doesn't work if the online world does not go offline. So the data showed people during the Obama 2012 campaign, which I have to say was this really breakthrough technological campaign, that most of the people following them on Facebook, following them on Twitter, they were going to vote for them. They didn't have to win those people over. The reason to keep feeding those people and stoking them was to try to get them to move offline and be so excited that they said to their neighbor, that they said to their friend, hey, will you go to the polls with me? Or, hey, have you heard about, you know, voting for Barack Obama? I think you should, and here's why you should. I actually talked to Teddy Goff, who was the digital director of that Obama 2012 campaign, and he said, look, we're at a 50-year low in people believing in government. What people believe in is their friends.
It's quite clear people don't trust politicians. They're increasingly sort of inured to political ads, but they really trust what they hear from, you know, validators in their community, people who are in their lives, personal friends. And so the strategy was not, you know, to put out a cute picture of the president and his dog and hope that that persuaded somebody. It was to put out that kind of content, hope that that kept our supporters inspired and engaged, and then send them off to be a much more persuasive spokesperson for us than we ourselves as a campaign could be.
So this really means getting away from the idea of candidate as brand maker and really using social media to create more of a movement with a candidate at the center, but the candidate not defining everything here. And do we have the tools to do that sort of thing?
We are developing them. So I'll tell you a couple of really interesting things that are happening. One is on the television landscape. So for a long time, it was just that politicians would take a ton of money, throw it at radio, throw it at TV, throw it at print, and hope that it hit somebody whose mind could be changed. But really, they didn't know who they were hitting. And now what we're seeing in 2014 already, this is the first campaign where this is going to happen, and it's going to happen more in 2016. You can tailor your 30-second ads to the things that you've learned using social media, using big data about the people in that house. Already this is available in 20 million homes. DirecTV and Dish is already allowing this to happen. Pandora, which you know creates sort of customized radio for people, is allowing politicians to target ads to people. And this is just going to get more and more pervasive as cable set-top boxes get traded out for more sophisticated hardware. Another thing we're seeing that Teddy Goff told me about is we're going to see websites so tailored to what you are interested in that you and I will go to the website of a politician and we will see two different websites. Here's Teddy Goff.
Pretty much everybody saw more or less the same version of BarackObama.com, whether you were an undecided voter in Florida or a diehard supporter in New York City. And that's not going to be how it goes in 2016. You know, the same applies to social media. The same applies to email. You know, basically every aspect of the campaign is going to be much more highly targeted, highly personalized.
And, you know, what's so ironic here is that, you know, one of the issues in the campaign, both in 2014 and especially in 2016, will be the technology and what it can do for people like the NSA and the National Security Establishment. And yet some of the same techniques that the NSA can use will be used with relish by the campaigns to make sure they're targeting the right people and trying to get them into the voting booth, right?
Yeah, and I think what frightens me a little bit, actually, is that you're going to have candidates sitting in war rooms saying, we only want people who make more than $100,000 a year to see this ad. I really, you know, wouldn't want somebody who makes $40,000 a year to see this ad. So make sure that nobody sees it who makes that much money. And so people will be, you know, maybe voting all for the same person, but they're going to be living in different realities in terms of thinking about that person, their policies, and the message that they put out there about themselves, because it's everything is tailored to you.
As a journalist, before we go, do you think this diminishes or amplifies the impact of money in the campaign? That's certainly going to be an issue.
I think it amplifies it, because what you're going to have is you're going to have politicians, and this was true in 2012, looking for the best technological minds out there. They're going to be looking for the slightest advantage over the other guy. And that means maybe luring people away from a Facebook, from a Google, where they're doing very, very sophisticated stuff like this. And so money is going to be, as it always is, I think, at a premium in terms of figuring out the absolute best way to create the campaign that, John, it's just for you.
Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub for PRI and WGBH Radio. Thanks so much, Kara.
Thanks, John.
You know, it seems as though I have always been reading the words of Nadine Gordimer. She died over the weekend at age 90. South Africa's first Nobel Prize winner for literature. I was reading her words yesterday tearfully as the thunder rumbled over a rainy New York City, evoking the endless African vistas she always described. The rainy places, the dry places, all the dignified faces, the proper young girl eyes bursting with life, staring down authority. The mouths resolute with power and grace. She wrote of the determination of the oppressed to be free, of the struggle to free herself from the prison of being a white woman in South Africa. Raised by South Africa's strict race rules as a young girl, she became part of the activist mixed-race crowd as a college student when she started out as a writer.
Journalists, actors, people who in the arts who normally indeed don't follow the rules, the conservative rules, and where the feeling about the incredible distortions of racism, not only the oppression of blacks, but the distortions in your personality, in your mind as a white. These became very much part of my life and indeed started my way to freedom.
Nadine Gordimer speaking shortly after winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. You can hear that radiant, almost thermonuclear frailty as she speaks. My next guest and I share two details. Until Sunday, our entire lives were spent in a world where Nadine Gordimer lived. In this conversation, though, our second shared detail, it will take place entirely in a world where she's no longer with us. Zeke Mda, South African novelist and creative writing professor at Ohio University, joins me now. It is a pleasure to meet and speak with you, Zeke.
Well, it's my pleasure, John.
I think Nadine Gordimer is probably one of the most relevant writers who ever wrote, in that she was always writing about something that was happening, tangible change right now.
Oh, certainly. You know, she was one of the most relevant writers in South Africa. And we are very, very, very sad that she left us.
How did you experience her growing up?
Well, you know, she was a staple. We read her work, even though some of her books were banned, but we continued to read them underground. You know, you could go to jail for reading some of her works. It was a crime because there was strict censorship in South Africa those days.
What was your impression of her bravery reaching across this boundary?
Oh, well, we admired her. That is why amongst us, even to this day, you know, we refer to her as Comrade Nadine. And of course, as we grew up, you know, she mentored a number of us, black writers. And we got to know her personally, and she became a friend, and we worked with her. We traveled the world with her. and we basked in her fame and in her generosity. She was a great person, not just a great writer, but a wonderful, wonderful human being as well.
What did she teach you?
First and foremost, of course, you know, generosity was one of the main things because, you know, she didn't talk about it, she lived it. She shared herself. For instance, after she won that Nobel Prize, most of that money she plowed back into developing black writers in South Africa. So she was a very generous, a very compassionate person.
I was reading your work and her work last night, and I was struck by the opening lines of your novel, Way of Dying, and the beginning of one of her stories, the moment before the gun went off. And both scenes are about funerals where the people who are mourning are struggling to understand how external political forces will impose meaning on these deaths. In one case, blacks, in the other case, whites. And the poor people are just so overwhelmed by the politics that are determining their relationships with their loved ones. It was astounding, the intersection between those two scenes.
Well, of course, you see, ours was a culture of death, you know, a culture of funerals. So I'm sure even that story, I would expect, you know, there would be those funerals and so on because, you know, we lived in a world of death and funerals. And it was through funerals, in fact, that we celebrated life. It was through funerals that we expressed ourselves politically, especially during the period when political expression through other means was banned. So it would be at the funeral that people would express themselves. That is why then you find that in our literature, in our stories, funerals would feature a lot.
What do you think she says to the people of today?
Well, you know, she was a very honest person. During apartheid, she joined the liberation movement, and she did not only write about the oppression and the freedom of the oppressed people. She actually participated in the freedom struggle. She, as a person, not just as a writer. After we achieved the freedom, she continued as a member of the ANC, which is the ruling party. But when the ANC or its leadership began, for instance, to show, you know, some weaknesses here and there, we began to see some corruption in its ranks and so on, he did not hesitate, you know, to be critical of his of her own. She did not hesitate to be critical of her own comrades. So, you know, she was very outspoken. That is another lesson that we learned from her.
Zeke Smeda, South African novelist and creative writing professor at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Zeke, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
To end this hour, an homage and a puzzle. At a moment when we think about the humility and radicalism of Nadine Gordimer and wonder about the tangible change legacy of the soon-to-be outgoing first African-American U.S. President Barack Obama, at a moment where we are wondering, or maybe not wondering so much, if Hillary Clinton will run for president in 2016, where in history are we to place this revolutionary woman?
I stand before you to proclaim tonight, America is the land where dreams can come true for all of us.
1984, New York Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro accepts the nomination for vice president on the Democratic ticket, the first such nomination from one of the major political parties. Ferraro was Walter Mondale's running mate against Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and we know how that turned out in November. But Ferraro stayed active in politics until her death in 2011, even commenting on the 2008 campaigns of Clinton and Obama.
You know, I looked at the candidates who were there. To be quite frank, I didn't even think of Barack Obama, because I didn't know him. I never met him. You know, she's my senator. I've seen her at work. She's delivered. But, God, she's a woman. And every time a woman runs, it does have impact on what women and girls think they can do.
This year, on the 30th anniversary of her run, there's a new documentary that tells her story. Veteran TV producer and filmmaker Donna Zaccaro is the director and producer of Geraldine Ferraro, Paving the Way. Also, daughter of Geraldine Ferraro. Donna, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Was your mother a victim of timing in that 1984 was early and perhaps late? This question of symbol versus tangible sort of feminist icon is a real tension in this film.
Yes. I don't know that I think she was early or late, that it was necessarily too early for a woman. What I think the issue was really, and a number of people in the film talk mm-hmm. about it, that, you know, Reagan was so popular and the economy was doing so well. Now, Hunt actually says in the film that he could have put Jesus Christ on the ticket and they still would have lost. So her vice presidency, actually, when they did sort of all the tabulations and analyzed it, made a slight difference, which is more than any other vice presidential candidate actually did in a positive direction.
Is that shrewd of Walter Mondale in retrospect, or is it disingenuous in the sense that Mondale understood he couldn't win, so Geraldine, carry me into the White House is kind of the message there?
Well, it could have been seen as a Hail Mary pass or political expediency, as I think it was in the McCain choice of Sarah Palin. But, I mean, remember, back then, he was the first one to actually open the whole vetting process to people, all different groups that were excluded. He had not just women. He interviewed other women. He interviewed Dianne Feinstein, but he also interviewed African-Americans. He interviewed, you know, Mayor Bradley. He interviewed Latinos, Cisneros. So I really think this was, and I still think he sees this as an extension of all his civil rights work mm-hmm. and opening the doors for other people to be seriously considered for this role. And she was a very credible politician, remember, at the time.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, she had risen to leadership within the House within three terms. She was what is now called the vice chairman of the House.
Remind people and young women listening particularly what her origins were in the New York political universe.
Well, her first run for office was actually for Congress
right, in
1978. She had, prior to that, she had stayed home. She had gone to law school at night while she was a teacher during the day, and she had stayed home while there were three of us, three children, until I was 13. And then she went and became an assistant district attorney in Queens and actually handled all the sex crimes, senior citizen crimes, and child abuse cases and created the first Special Victims Bureau name mm-hmm. and named it that. She was actually the one who named it that.
Was she aware of just how much attention she would get? We're going to listen to a little clip from the Geraldine Ferraro documentary, Paving the Way, talking about the 1984 campaign trail. Listen.
Someone said to me, don't you feel badly about all this stuff, the attention you're getting, and, you know, would you get it if you were not female? I don't feel the least bit badly about it. Not at all.
That's what she says in public. Did she ever nudge you and go, man, this is just carrying a burden?
Yes, it was a very difficult campaign. And in the film, I actually did bring up all mm-hmm. the attacks that she and my father were subjected to. I mean, she was a first and she was a pioneer. So they understood that it was going to be different and it was going to be harder. And, you know, I think if she hadn't run for vice president, she would have run for the Senate. And I think she would have won at that point. She didn't in subsequent races. So I think that's a real shame. I think she understood that
she was... A mistake or a shame?
No, I just think she would have been a wonderful senator. But I think that she never regretted having accepted that nomination because she truly felt that if she could conduct a campaign in such a way that was credible, she could show that women, she really felt that she was representing women, could be in the highest leadership positions in this country. And I think she achieved that. So that's, you know, even though they lost by such a landslide, I think one of the lessons, well, certainly of the film, but of her life, is that you can even have impact in failure.
What about impact in the Clinton years? A bond with Hillary Clinton, not so much. That part of the sort of Democratic Leadership Council that moved the party back to the right. What was her feminist mission, if she had one, as you understood it, as her daughter?
Well, she always felt that it was really important to have women in office. I mean, and actually, when you look at Obama, it's the same thing. Now that there is an African-American president, little African-American boys and girls know they can be president. Until you see yourself there, you don't really believe you can do it. So that's what was so important to her. So she continued to always campaign for women running for office, who were credible, obviously, and became very close to Hillary Clinton over the years.
Not that Hillary's asking for any advice, but what do you think the lesson is your mom would give to Hillary Clinton if she runs in 2016, based on her experience, based on her life?
Well, she already has a thick skin, I think. And I think my mother would say, well, you need even more of a thick skin. But then also to remember always what's important to you, your family, the people you're close to. And, you know, it's when you're in the midst of that sort of a campaign, it's so difficult. I know she had talked to Hillary in the midst of her last campaign and said to her, you know, just try and make sure that you keep in touch with what's important to you personally.
Be yourself.
Through all that. Yeah.
Be yourself. And don't eat the shrimp hors d'oeuvres at the campaign events. Otherwise, you get food poisoning, that sort of thing. Donna, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Donna Zaccaro is the daughter of Geraldine Ferraro, director and producer of a documentary about her mother, Geraldine Ferraro, Paving the Way. It airs on Showtime throughout July. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A discussion of how Geraldine Ferraro might have changed things for women in politics. How has Barack Obama change things for minorities in politics? One of you in Florida, I would not say that he has, but he never promised that he would, so I never expected him to. Although I am African-American, I am not expecting preferential treatment. I think that he should do things for all people and not just one group in particular. Tyrone writes on Facebook that President Obama hasn't done enough. Tyrone writes, jobs, job training, and stressing upward mobility is what's to be addressed.
This is Danny Simon from West Bloomfield, Michigan. I think that the president is left with the option of waiting for a Supreme Court justice like Scalia or Thomas to retire so he could appoint someone that's less anti-civil rights.
Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.